And in an interruption to the scheduled programming, last weekend I was out and about and discovered that the two other people whose voices you're just about to hear were out and about in the same location as I was. And given that we've been working together on a book, we couldn't resist getting together for lunch to chat about the project. And given who the three of us are, one thing led to another, and you can guess the rest. The book we've been writing, together with a half a dozen other authors, is called Hating to Love, and it's basically a re-examination of those Doctor Who stories for which there isn't, or rather, for which there hasn't always been, a lot of love. It'll be out later this year, and no doubt you'll be hearing a lot more about it closer to the time. So when it came to choosing a topic to talk about in our off-the-cuff podcast, you can guess what happened. You're listening to the Blue Box Podcast, and for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking about Doctor Who so that you don't have to. I'm JR.
Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Betsy Chevron.
And I've said this a million times. Nobody ever sets out to make a bad doctor. Nobody ever sets out to make a bad anything. Or very rarely. Probably about once in every million things that people make do they deliberately set out to do it badly.
Yep.
And usually for that's for some other reason than just purely to come up with something that's bad. Nobody ever sets out to make a bad Doctor Who story, but it does happen. And we are gathered here today to discuss what possible reasons there might be for things not turning out as well as they might. Betsy, seeing as you're the lady in the room, and of course ladies must go first. In order to get into this subject, let's come up with a idea of a bad Doctor Who story and then try and fathom what it was that went wrong in between people sitting down and saying this is going to be brilliant and it turning out not brilliant. So just come up with an example.
It's fresh in my mind, so I'm going to say Warriors of the Deep.
Okay, Al, right, it's your turn now. Warriors of the Deep. No, I don't want you to come up with another example. I want you to come up with a reason why Warriors of the Deep, instead of being the big blockbuster sci-fi monsters and underwater spaceships spectacular that it should have been, Murka, great big dinosaur under the sea. Warriors of the Deep, on paper, looks amazing.
Yep.
Al, what is the first thing that went wrong with that story?
The first thing that goes wrong with that story is having an opening scene that stretches across 1.5 episodes.
Right. That's not really what I was after.
No, it's
what's a really obvious thing about that story?
Well, it's production. It's the production. That's what's gone wrong. It's the interpretation of the text. The text that as is there is not entirely what's come through and been live. It's the realization of it. It's the way that it's come through when they've tried to make it real. It's for whatever reason, everything's sort of pulling in a different direction with it. And so as a result, you don't end up with a Cold War and an analogy.
Well, that's interesting. Before we go any further, you say everything's pulling in a different direction.
Okay.
And one of the initial things about that story that I always think of when I think, oh, Warriors of the Deep, that hasn't quite worked out, is the script is by Johnny Byrne.
Yep.
And he's being script edited by Eric Saward.
Yep.
And whereas Johnny Byrne was given his legs with his first two stories, mm-hmm, The Keeper mm-hmm. of Traken and Ark of Infinity.
Yeah.
I think Ark of Infinity works a lot better than a lot of people do, but that's by the by. Here we've got Johnny Byrne, who is a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And although his trade is in writing television like Space 1999, really at heart he's a poet. And you can tell that when you watch Keeper of Traken. But here Eric Saward is telling him to write a blockbuster sci-fi movie.
Well, it is. It's an 80s action. Well, as a lot of it is. It's an 80s action film, isn't it? It's The Abyss, really. But pre The Abyss, and with much, much less budget. And it just doesn't... Although, not to keep coming back to the limitations that you've got there, because it's the execution of the of elements of it are just not sympathetic for the way that they should have been with the script.
And on the subject of Johnny Byrne, he's trying to introduce elements that are more more of his ethos. Mm-hmm. That's not the word I was looking for, but never mind. He's trying to find elements to put into the plot that are more attuned to his way of thinking. And Eric Saywood presumably is telling him, no, need monsters, need action, need explosions, etc., etc. And there's a bit of a disconnect between what he's trying to get going on with the characters and what the characters are actually doing.
Very much so, because he's got a lyricist.
Betsy, jump in as much as you like.
Yeah, go for it.
Go on.
Well, no, because there's a lyricism to his writing, which is really which is really in there in Keeper of Charkham, which is almost Shakespearean, isn't it? It's kind of like lovely and grim, and it's like it's the evil in the earth. That's what it's about, which you can't really get going when you're in an undersea sort of thing, which is like
the evil under the sea.
And evil under the sea. Yes, yes, yes. Singing crabs and everything. But you've got this whole kind of it's very difficult because you can't have this lyrical interplay between the two separate species of misunderstood creatures that have been awakened in order to come back and do this in the same way that they would have done when you got it with Hulk and you're arguing about different aspects of morality and all sorts of things. That's not coming through here when essentially they're just turned into officers.
Yeah.
Really, just arguing about, you know, right, your orders are to do this, your orders are to do that. And it's very difficult to get poetry into official orders. You can't get lyricism into it.
What Eric Saywood wants to do is turn Doctor Who into a teen action adventure series like The A-Team.
Yes, which is what he was up against, wasn't it?
And he was obviously into sort of gritty policiers like The Sweeney and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to get the atmosphere of The Sweeney and the action from The A-Team into Doctor Who. But obviously, The Sweeney's for grown-ups, but Doctor Who still has to at least try and be for kids. So rather than have gangsters going around shooting people in the head, you've got lizards that live under the sea, which is not quite the same thing. So it doesn't work in quite the same way. And then you've got, you know, The A-Team. It's made in the States.
Yeah.
They have a completely different production sensibility over there. Mm-hmm. And they do action. And they do it by second nature. And they've got the money and the editing facilities and lots of second units.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah.
Second unit is something which Doctor Who has never had. And, well, look what happens when there is a second unit. You get the Raston Warrior robot sequence in The Five Doctors, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But Doctor Who, other than that example, never has a second unit. Mm. So you're trying to do all this stuff with the... Well, it's not even with a single unit. With a single unit in a television studio, shooting as live on videotape, with no editing, with scene mixing.
Yeah.
So you can't do that stuff. So the problem with Warriors of the Deep is not just that you've got the wrong writer on it, because if Eric Saywood wanted somebody to come in and write the big action blockbuster to start the series, it shouldn't have been the guy who wrote Keeper of Tracking.
No, definitely not.
And then you've got a production that isn't able to live up to the production techniques that you're trying to copy.
But it's also not been... Sorry, just one time. One thing, and then you have...
Betsy is in the room.
She is. Yeah. She's going to... Don't worry. she'll make that clear.
She's absolutely biting her lip. Because on Bidrow was right, she never goes this long without talking.
What I was going to say is that what you end up with then is coming back to The Abyss, is an attempt to make The Abyss as a single stage, single act drawing room comedy. Which is going to explode, but keeping the same script.
Which is
a little bit of a tricky way to approach it when the budget has dropped to the point where you can't actually do any special effects, really.
Although it has to be pointed out that Warriors of the Deep was made 5 years before The Abyss came out.
Yeah, I know. It's a bad example, but the one I'm thinking of is really 80s single word heroes, you know, like Stallone, Cobra, you know.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger. Kindergarten, all these sorts of things that you get going with a different sort of...
And here we've got Davison, underwater lizards.
Yeah, Davison, Doctor, that sort of, Silvix. Silurian. Or Eocene, I don't know. I'm digging, you say
but,
something.
I mean, for me, you guys are far more up on the production side of things than I am anyway. But even on a... For me, the reason that it just sort of confuses the hell out of me is entirely narrative, and like Al said about how the first scene stretches till halfway through the second episode, it almost feels like you're watching it, and you've got a Doctor Who serial that someone's taped off of the TV, but somehow they've every now and then taped over bits of it with a different serial. Because there's this incredible disconnect in terms of pace and narrative, where you've got the Silurians taking 3 weeks to finish a sentence, yeah, and then all of a sudden you cut to Ingrid Pitt stomping around. And
that's the trouble with having Pennant Roberts behind the director's chair as well. I mean, he makes a right mess of the Silurians, but I suspect that was imposed on him. But he's more of a...
The episodes were running very short.
Yeah, no, considered think... slow motion so, for any scene without dialogue. Yeah.
I think you'll find, actually, the episodes were running really short.
It reminds me a little bit of Walking Dead, in which you reach a point at which the story has obviously been going far too fast for a long while, and someone goes, Rick, we need to have a talk. It's just like, well, that's it now for the next 15 minutes.
I'll make a cup of tea, and then you watch someone boiling the kettle for 5 minutes.
You come back in just to see someone just go...
During the 1990s, all American TV, everybody was taking themselves really seriously.
No humour.
And speaking about 2 octaves lower than they would in conversation. Mm-hmm. And it was just interminable. Mm-hmm. I can't even watch The X-Files because of that.
Oh, some of the X-Files episodes have got loads of humour in them, and some of them, and the ones that don't, it's just you can't take it that seriously because it's hilarious. But the premise is hilarious. You've got to keep a sense of you can't just kind of, you know, tape a step back and it's just madness.
Right, back to Warriors of the Deep.
Go on, then.
One thing, okay, that I think that we have established so far is you have to... You shouldn't not be ambitious.
No, not at all.
But you should realise what your capabilities are and tailor your ambitions to your capabilities.
Yeah.
And a really good example of that is the Dalek invasion of Earth, which is a ridiculously ambitious story. Mm-hmm. But Terry Nation, for all his faults, knows that they're recording it in a television studio. Mm-hmm. So whereas if that had been made as a feature film, you'd have lots of short scenes with lots of action and lots of things going on and the plot moving forward at a ridiculous breakneck speed, what you've actually got is lots of scenes of people sitting around in rooms talking about what's happening.
Yeah.
But it's really well executed and it's coherent, which is something that Warriors of the Deep isn't.
Mm. Because they did what Russell T. Davis did so brilliantly in Aliens of London, which was exactly what he did in The Second Coming. He said, here we're telling a global story, but we don't have the globe to play with, so let's get a load of people in a room and they can tell you what's happening outside the room, and we'll show enough of what's happening outside the room, inside the room, that you get enough of an idea of it. So in The Second Coming, basically the entire second episode of that is Christopher Eccleston locked up, while on the outside the world is going to hell in a handcart because they think Jesus is here.
Yeah, but there's a lot of cinematic and TV shorthand that people are so used to now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
As long as you've got someone speaking French that looks like they're hosting the news and the caption saying this is what's happening, and then someone speaking English saying the exact same thing, immediately everyone knows it's global. Then throw in an American accent and it's really serious. And then you're done. You don't need to go any further.
You need to know what your production boundaries are and use what you've got. And Warriors of the Deep doesn't use what you've got, and the Dalek invasion of Earth does.
Yeah, Warriors of the Deep also, it's got a slightly different case of wandering accent syndrome to the sort that's exhibited by Dodo, in that you've got everyone on the base is all supposed to be on the same side, including Ingrid Pitt, who's using her proper villain voice for this particular performance, and it's really hard to tell which side is this supposed to be? And then when it comes down to them saying it's the other side that we're against, they don't name or say anything about them so that you can kind of like pinpoint that it's, you know, which I suppose is a way of making it a really subtle analogy, but it's kind of, you can't tell which side is which.
And the makeup makes it even more subtle because just they all look...
That's the thing. I think at one point I was watching it and I just went, I don't know how he's done his eye makeup, but I want to be able to do that.
maybe if you ask him.
Well, I think the other thing that...
Someone, before you go on, someone somewhere sat in a room and thought, what will people be doing in 100 years? Ooh, they'll all be spending 3 hours at the start of the day getting themselves made up before they go to work.
Quite a few people do.
Works for robots to death.
Yeah, that's true. It does.
So it's kind of, but then, in but Robots then that's of supposed Death, to be decadent, isn't it?
That's a, yeah, kind of like that's a, the idea is yeah. that none of them do work. And also, in Robots of Death, the makeup and the set design and the costume design all work together. Whereas in Warriors of the Deep, they've all got this ridiculous makeup and they're wearing jumpsuits and they're in a white-walled studio.
Yes, and it's very separate because in a way, the only way, part of the reason, passively, oh, that's a bit odd, I don't know where that came from. Part of the reason where you've got the two different areas where the two different conflicts are taking place. The sea base, it's white and everything's really white and really well lit because they've got to match it with the Bond pool or whatever, where they filmed the location stuff.
Yeah.
And everything sea devilish or Eocene-esque or whatever is all very dark. So you know that you're in a different place. You're not going to confuse the two performances. Not that the characters are performing in similar fashions, but it's so that you're aware, oh, we're over here now, or oh, we're over here now. You know, it's kind of... Because the lighting's not...
I've never had a problem with the lighting in Warriors of the Deep, because if you were working in an undersea base, you wouldn't expect it to be dimly lit.
No, this is just it. But the problem is...
It's very IKEA strip lighting, and that's fine.
Yeah, but it's unsympathetic for the rest of the... It highlights the other things that maybe you get away with. Like, you probably get away with Ingrid Pitt. Because she's lovely, you know, without it just being so obvious what's there, you know. Where you
and you'd get away with the disconnect costumes. Between the lighting and the costumes if you couldn't see either of them as
clearly. I do think the lighting makes it very... It's very strange that lighting does make it difficult. If the lighting's not subtle, it makes it difficult to give a subtle performance. So if you're sort of trying to make a sinister face, I might not be what I seem, if all you've got is just bright white light hitting you everywhere... There's no way to hide. There's no way to make a subtle facial expression.
A bit like Under a Mask, when you hear often a person who's performing under a mask, they'll say that they've got to accentuate
big faces
in order to get that across. It's almost like because you're so revealed as to what you're doing, you're almost over. It becomes like a theatrical performance. You're performing to people who are far away.
You were about to make a point just now. Do you remember what it was going to
be?
Okay, it's gone. Okay, let's choose another story and then see if we can draw a line between the two stories. Al, it's your turn to choose a story.
Oh, okay.
Move away from the 80s and just think of any other story. Perhaps new series that really doesn't work very well. New series would be good because production is not going to be the issue.
Production's not going to be... Well...
Oh, try not to think of the obvious one.
Yeah, no, there's a couple that I'm sort of jumping. Do you know... all right, okay, Fear Her.
Oh, I was going to say, that is the obvious
one. Oh, right, I was thinking you were going to say Love and Monsters. Because I defend
that. Oh, no, that's Marmite-y, so...
Yeah,
I don't think
really?
I don't think Love and... I mean, it's
brown and sticky.
It's a stick.
Love and Monsters is one of those stories that people don't like if they don't like the idea.
Yeah.
And if they like the idea, they like the story.
I don't know, I quite like the basic premise. I think the basic premise is something that I've seen in other places and really enjoyed it. For me, the execution is really the problem. The execution and the dialogue is really the problem for me with Love and Monsters.
Really?
Yeah.
Go on then, let's do Love and Monsters.
Go on then, do it,
but expand on that.
I think, well, the whole concept is, it's not a new one. But I'm part of it, and this is a very personal response, I'm a big fan of Shirley Henderson.
Yeah.
And I think she just could have been used so well in Doctor Who at some point. I feel like she was wasted.
Oh, really? She's got a good part in that.
I think she could have done something more interesting.
Well, the thing about that is, that's coming at it after
but
the fact.
But that's after me also not liking other performances within it, and the pacing within it, and the... it's a problem I have with a few other stories, that there are a lot of references in there that if you have seen... monsters that assimilate people as victims and things like that, you'll know what to expect. And you just see tropes and you don't really see an original story. And there's also this sort of frenetic pace, stopping and starting, which took me out of it a little bit. I think I'm probably quite unfair on it.
Yeah, because all those things that are problems are actually things that are also successful if you do
like get that along kind with of Love and Monsters. And also if you are a sentimentalist, you'll like it.
Which yeah.
I don't think you need to be sentimental to like it.
But I think if you're willing to watch other people be cute with each other on screen, than you might be, but I have a bit of... I don't like people liking each other. It's sort of love stories on screen I get a bit tired of anyway. So that's part of it.
Love and Monsters is probably not the best example, though.
No, I've got a better one. No, I should have suggested, but what I was going to say with Love and Monsters is something that's interesting about it, is that it's... A lot of times, you'll find that Doctor Who kind of collides with a different genre or a different type of story. And in some ways, what happens with Love and Monsters is it collides with television, and it's the story kind of is it, it's a collision of many, many channels and of jumping across when you watch it with the way that it's executed, not necessarily the way it is with the script, and that the, and so you're kind of seeing it as a very modern take where everything jumps from there are very many different styles within Love and Monsters. You've got like a sitcom moment. You've got kind of, in fact, there's sort of like different levels of sitcom. You've got Scooby-Doo moment. You've got
and soap opera.
Yeah, soap opera moments. There's a bit of an X-Files moment when he's remembering back to his childhood and the Doctor's standing there looking down and the shadow monsters have eaten his mum and that sort of thing. And it's all kind of mashed up within it.
And it's got plenty of ELO moments.
Yes, lots of.
Well, there's that as well. Yes. That's what I meant. Yes. You put it beautifully.
What Love and Monsters probably does is. What it does is it takes what Russell T. Davis has been doing for the past 18 months and it takes all the subplots that Russell T. Davis has been playing with for the last 18 months, primarily the way the characters are relating to one another, but also things like, oh God, we're doing Doctor Who and it's got monsters in and monsters are silly, so here's a really silly monster.
Yeah.
And it takes the sort of the sentimentality out of the way Russell T. Davis has finished the stories, because in almost all of Russell T. Davis's stories, what actually defeats the monster is a deus ex machina, in technical terms, that is not a deus ex machina in character terms, because if you ignore the plot, the story, he has the characters doing something emotionally that builds up to the point at which triumph occurs, and then the aftermath of the triumph is people coming to terms with what they've done. And although the moment of triumph might be a deus ex machina in technical terms, in emotional terms, the characters have earned it.
Yeah.
And he takes that, and that becomes Love and Monsters, and then he throws in all the subplots that he's been working with and turns them into the A plot of Love and Monsters, so that the A plot of all these other stories becomes the B plot. And so what he does is he comes up with the episode that is the absolute epitome of Russell T. Davis's approach to Doctor Who. And perhaps, well, definitely, if you've reacted badly against Love and Monsters, what you're doing is you're reacting badly against Russell T. Davis rather than the story itself, I think. And so maybe if what we're going to do here in this podcast is say, right, what's the problem? The problem there is making an assumption as the writer that people are enjoying your stuff because they like the same things you do. And so by coming up with an episode that focuses on all the things you like about your own writing at the expense of all the other things that it maybe transpires is what those people watching it were enjoying instead.
Yeah.
So what you've done is you've alienated the people who were watching Doctor Who because they like Doctor Who, not because they like Russell T. Davis writing Doctor Who.
I think when it was on, I was watching it and going, okay, so Doctor Who's not on this week. What have they replaced it with? Yeah. I'm very confused by it. I think that was more than the design of the monster, more than the portrayal of the monster, more than the way the characters interacted and the emotional bits and the pacing. I just sort of went, I wasn't expecting this when I sat down to watch Doctor Who. And that's a very unfair way to assess something, I suppose. But I also think, I've said before publicly and at length, that I find it very difficult as someone who doesn't like or have children to remember that it's a kids' show. I don't like or have them. I don't always remember that it's ostensibly a children's programme. And I'm not sure if Love and Monsters is an episode of a kids' show.
The only thing about Love and Monsters is that it's got the Blue Peter competition winner in it.
Yeah.
And that's it, isn't it?
But it also ends with a joke about very inappropriate...
That you'd only take as that joke if you knew what that was. So, I mean,
maybe that's just my mind then.
Well, any 8-year-old watching, when he says love life, any 8-year-old watching is going to think, well, her face is still there. They can still kiss each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But the point is...
See, I hadn't even thought about it like that.
But it's... But you're right. There's no, the story is about what grown-ups get up to.
Yeah.
Mm.
And whereas...
But I don't think it's the interesting side of what grown-ups get up to.
No, yeah, not for children, no. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The story is about what grown-ups get up to. But we were discussing this just before we started the podcast. Stephen Moffat tends to write grown-up stories from the perspective of how children see them,
mm.
whereas Russell T. Davies, because he doesn't have kids, and because he... And try as much as you might, if you don't have kids, I don't think you can, he can't empathise with how children see it. And so even though he thinks he's writing...
I'm sure he was a child at some point.
He was, but I think you forget part of what that is unless you've been given constant reminders of it.
And childhood has changed.
Oh, yeah, childhood has definitely changed. But I also think that, again, I've said this a lot, I think Stephen Moffat writes as much for parents as he does for children. And I think... Mm. I'm the person who's left out of the demographic now because not being a child and not being a parent who wants to watch something with my child or wants to identify with parents on screen, because there are a lot of parents in Moffat Doctor Who. There are a lot of parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. A lot of parents and a lot of children.
Yeah. And for me, I sort of sit there going, I have no experience of this. This is very strange.
Yeah, but...
But in Love and Monsters, I think it's not for parents... Or for children,
yeah,
and it's something completely outside of
when
the genre.
When Love and Monsters was first on, its position within there are a few things about it. I mean, the first thing that you got to go with for really what the intention was the title, because it's the first time you've got an ampersand that's ever been used in Doctor Who. So it's Love and Monsters. So that's the first time that's in there, and that was something that Russell T. Davies was teasing before it came out. That we've changed something with the title. It's something totally new that's never been done in a Doctor Who title before, and that is true. But that kind of shorthand that's gone into the title, the kind of modern version of it, the way that it's been broken down, it's an experiment. That was an experimental decision that he made. And I remember watching the show to begin with, and the moment you get the blipvert of Elton John singing that moment when he goes, I was named after Elton, and then it comes up and it's kind of like there, and it's Elton John, and it goes back into it. That felt very much like the sort of thing that you'd be seeing in something that was slightly more experimental and sassy and almost post-spaced. That there was an idea that you've got that although that this is something that's been produced within massively popular culture, it's also referencing popular culture around it. And it was kind of like Doctor Who talking about, like you were saying, it's Doctor Who talking about Doctor Who within a modern TV age. And it was very, very experimental for what it did, which is probably why they've never done it again.
Well, there's a TV show that it reminded me of, and you've just reminded me of that. And I don't know if either of you would have watched it because it's very much for teens of my generation, which was a television show called As If.
I can see where that I can see where that would
which
be going.
Was set around a load of college students at college, all with their distinct but very cool personalities, and each episode would be narrated from the perspective of that character,
right,
and it would be that person's story that week.
Mm-hmm.
It was all very young adult fiction problems, but mm-hmm. with cool people with multicolored dreadlocks, and the band Busted wrote a song about one of the characters. That's what age I am, guys. contemporaries of Busted. But the format of it, it's quite a lot like Queer as Folk as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got that feel in the cutting and the production.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much like As If. So it's, if anything, it's sort of for late teens, early 20s, I think. That's that episode is it's just... I'm repeating myself, but it's not for kids.
No, it's what Russell T. Davies, probably not deliberately, but accidentally was doing, was writing Doctor Who for people in their late teens and early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And what Stephen Moffat's not, I don't think.
But that seems like the weirdest possible choice, because...
Ooh. I don't think it's choice, that's what I mean.
No,
it's...
because you're not appealing, because, again, something I've said before, I was born a couple of years before the last episode of the original series aired. So I don't really have any memories of Doctor Who. So coming into the new Doctor Who, you had a built-in audience of people who were big fans, remembered it. You also had the young kids who'd never heard of it before, and it would be a completely new experience. And then for the people who grew up in the wilderness years and unless you had Sky TV and no friends, probably didn't catch
the
classic Doctor Who like I did. I don't think, you know, I just started uni in 2005 when it came
out. Well, this is probably the clever thing that Russell T Davies did. He knew he'd get the kids and the parents, so he angled it towards the people he knew he wouldn't get otherwise, which is the teenagers who'd missed Doctor Who. But in doing so, I think he probably accidentally went too far in that direction, so that by the time you get Rose coming back in Series 4 and that big long goodbye at the end of Series 4 and all the shenanigans that have gone on in between, he's kind of made it ostentatiously for the teens rather than accidentally for the teens, which is probably, Love and Monsters is probably one of the moments across those 4 years where it stepped up a notch in that direction. It's probably Love and Monsters is a watermark in Russell T Davies making it accidentally for that group.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have expected, because I think if anything is going to alienate the teen audience, it's, oh yeah, the monster in that was drawn by a kid. Oh, that's really sophomoric. That's not for us. That's for children.
But that's such a tiny part.
Yeah, I know, I know it's a tiny part of it, but before it came out, it was a big...
Yeah.
It was highly publicised.
Which is why I say accidental, because I think that gave him, the guts to go on. And because Doomsday, also just a couple of 3 episodes later in that series, is the point at which the 10th Doctor and Rose go through what they go through.
Yeah.
But so that was already written, so that was already going to happen. But it's what happens after that where Rose becomes the story, and you know. The 10th Doctor can't go an episode with Martha without talking about Rose.
Yeah.
And then Series 4, Rose turns up in the very first episode. So the whole of Series 4 is, how is Rose going to come back? And if you look at the specials, what's going on in the specials is the Doctor is having a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And why is he having a breakdown? Because he's the Time Lord Victorious? Yeah, okay, no. It's actually because Rose has now gone off in the alternative universe with the new boyfriend, who's Clifford Jones, who's like the Doctor, but not really the Doctor.
Yeah.
And the Doctor's... And now the 10th Doctor is never going to get Rose
back. He's just having a really hard time with the breakup.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of where those specials went.
Which is really interesting, because what you've got there, then, is you've got a character whose shadow stretches through much, much longer than you'd expect, whereas when you look at Adric...
And I'm looking at Adric.
Yeah. I still got it, lads. When you look at... when you're looking at... I don't know what that means. When you're looking at that, you've got the end of Earthshock, which goes out, silent credits, terrible thing. It's awful. It's the worst thing that's ever happened ever. You know, like, under the Doctor's duty of care, a character has died. And then next week...
Yeah.
You know, which is slightly different to the approach of Rose's left.
The really weird thing about that is... I was come back to Love and Monsters in a second just to say one more thing, but... Actually, you've brought me back to Peter Davison, which is where I was going to go with Love and Monsters.
I can connect them, I think.
But yeah. Everything's connected.
It is.
So, but the funny thing about that is, under John Nathan Turner, they have stopped making Doctor Who stories that you can show out of sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, even the Key to Time stories, the first and the last one, yeah, but the ones in between you could show out of sequence with one another.
You know, I disagree with that entirely. Well, not entirely, but I think in some cases, and quite possibly very much in the theme of what we're talking about, there are episodes of Doctor Who that feel a bit fluffy and inconsequential because they can be shown out of sequence because they have because the series have become extended serials rather than anything else. And now, every now and then, you'll get an episode within a series that just has absolutely nothing to do with... I mean, a good example of it, of one that people liked, would be The Doctor's Wife, which you could put that anywhere in that series and it wouldn't make a difference.
Because, and they did. They moved it.
And they moved... Well, they did the same with Curse of the Black Spot, which I'm slightly less sympathetic towards. But, there are still episodes that can be shown out of sequence in Doctor Who and not affect the story arc, but they're usually the ones that are either very, very good or very, very bad. As standalone episodes.
Yeah, well, this is where I'm going.
Sorry. I should have kept my fat mouth shut.
No. But the point I was coming to is that in the 80s, they try and connect the stories together, but they don't put anything in to actually connect the stories together. Mm-hmm. Prior to the 1980s, they're not trying to connect the stories, so they're allowing each story to be as good or as bad as that story is on its own terms. And in the modern day, in spite of what I just said about... Well, in spite of everything we've just said, what's happening is... With stories like Love and Monsters, they're not feeding into an arc. Mm-hmm. But what they're doing is they're feeding from the other stories around them in terms of they're trying to... Unlike in the old days, where each story would stand or fall completely on its own merits. In the new series, the stories are eating into what makes the other stories around them good. So that if you do it well... Even though it's Doctor Who and you might be in the past, you might be on an alien planet, it will feel as if there's some kind of ongoing quality control. Not a theme necessarily, but a quality control. And the modern stories, because I think Curse of the Black Spot, in spite of the fact that it's not a great story, I don't think it's that bad a story. I think it looks bad. Compared to what's around it.
Oh, it's sandwiched between...
Two classics.
It's a sandwich between a very engaging and exciting two-parter and The Doctor's Wife.
And in fact, the six episodes before it are... Well, the seven episodes before it are Vincent and the Doctor, The Lodger, Pandorica Opens, Big Bang, Christmas Carol, Impossible Astronaut and Day of the Moon. And just in spite of what your particular tastes might be, they're all extremely successful episodes. So it's the first episode in about eight or nine that's not extremely successful.
Yeah.
But the where I'm going with this ultimately is Love and Monsters is an example of the showrunner kind of dictating his own terms onto a story rather than... Writing, instead of writing a Doctor Who story and letting it be a bit Russell T. Davis, he's writing a Russell T. Davis story and letting it be Doctor Who.
Yeah.
The other example we talked about just now was Warriors of the Deep. And what you're doing with Warriors of the Deep is, unlike, I don't know, it's not a great example, but Terry Nation writes The Dalek Invasion of Earth. Mm-hmm. And he says, here's this big story that's way too ambitious for what we can achieve. So what we'll do is we'll look at what's achievable and we'll do with the story... We'll deal with this story within the parameters of what's achievable. So what he does is he says, here's a Terry Nation story I'm bringing to you that's about World War II, but you're Doctor Who. So what I'll do is I'll write a Doctor Who story that has this Terry Nation story in it. Mm-hmm. And what they do with Warriors of the Deep is Eric Saywood says, right, here's an Eric Saywood story, which is guns and monsters and action and grittiness and adult drama.
Yeah.
And what we'll do is we'll let it be Doctor Who. Warriors of the Deep is primarily Saywood and secondarily Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. Love and Monsters is primarily Russell T. Davis and secondarily Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. But when stories work, in spite of being perhaps not quite as ambitious, say something like random middling example, Nightmare of Eden. It's not great, but it works because it's Doctor Who primarily and Bob Baker and... No, not even Bob Baker and Dave Martin, just Bob Baker. Doctor Who primarily and Bob Baker secondarily. So I think, and we're way too early to reach a conclusion, but I think we're getting there. So maybe we get to the conclusion, take a toilet break and come back and talk some more. Because I need the toilet. I think.
First do we come to? Upstairs.
I think what we'll do then, since we've got to a conclusion, is say what the conclusion is and then come back and ask if that conclusion works.
See if we can destroy it.
The conclusion, therefore, would be a Doctor Who story that is unsuccessful will by and large be a story that doesn't allow itself to be Doctor Who first, but that takes some other kind of imposition and tries to mess with the format, not in a way that comes out of the format, but in a way that's imposed upon the format.
Yeah, although I think it's very, very important to point out that that's not necessarily the writer. That can be from the direction. That can be from the...
Oh, no. Yeah, well. It can be from all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Like just that in those two examples, the obvious example is Russell T. Davis and Eric Saywood, right? Who are making the imposition. But whatever the imposition is, because perhaps then Dalek Invasion of Earth is a good example because that was a production imposition. But the point kind of therefore is you have to know what your parameters are. Even though Doctor Who is supposed to be a series without a format, it obviously has a very definite format, and it obviously has very definite parameters of what you can do and what you can get away with. Modern series, people say, oh, they've got so much more money, oh, there's so much more they can do, but they still got 2.5 weeks to make an episode and only so many pennies to spend on special effects. You know, there still is a format, and there still is boundaries to what the production can achieve.
But there are often examples of episodes that some people might consider the money savers, the bottle episodes like Midnight.
Yeah,
they're really successful.
Which benefit hugely from those constraints.
Because Russell T Davies is not trying to go beyond the parameters of what money is left at that point of the season.
Yeah, he's writing. Not only that, he's writing within the parameters for a bottle episode, and he's good, and he can do it.
And it's a great. But the thing is, it's written beautifully. It's a great episode, but it absolutely hinges on the performances. So if you'd had a performance, if you'd had a performance that wasn't of that standard, it would have completely collapsed. Thankfully, the casting was right.
Which brings
especially
us to
given David Troughton was second choice for the professor. That could have been. Who was the first, do you remember?
Not off the top of my head, no.
That'd be interesting. I can't remember.
Maybe we'll do some research
whilst
we take a break.
Very different. Yeah, okay, here's the break. And we're back.
Yes.
And so we've come to a conclusion, and what we're going to do now is see if the conclusion works. And so what we're probably going to do, even though while we were on the break we didn't talk about this, which we probably should have done if we were going to actually format this episode, but it's a Blue Box podcast, there is no format.
Excellent.
So let's throw a bunch of... Well, with the conclusion we came to was that Doctor Who stories tend not to work when somebody's bending the format in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And so what we're going to do is think of a few examples of stories that don't work and see if they fit that criteria. And the only one we said we'd mention was Al.
Nightmare in Silver.
So, Nightmare in Silver is... Okay, here's how I see Nightmare in Silver and why I don't think it works, yeah?
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Okay, Nightmare in Silver. The Doctor's wife is Neil Gaiman. And Neil Gaiman is famous for doing things like Coraline and or whatever else, where he builds his own universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doctor's Wife is an example of Neil Gaiman taking the kind of elements that would be in a Neil Gaiman universe and putting them in the Doctor Who universe. So Doctor's Wife is a Doctor Who story that has elements of Neil Gaiman in it. Nightmare in Silver, I think, is Neil Gaiman building a Neil Gaiman universe and then trying to transpose Doctor Who over the top of it. And I think that's why it doesn't work. Because in Doctor Who, even though Stephen Moffat has stretched the boundaries of what is logical within the Doctor Who universe, and with his sort of timey-wimey thing, that's the most... Hey, timey-wimey is an expression. We all know what
just
it means.
Just adding insult to injury by saying it again.
It's just a horrible
phrase.
But Doctor Who should be able to cope with time travel as an A-plot.
Yeah.
But it never has done in the past, except in one or two isolated examples.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's never done it as a core concept of the series. Stephen Moffat has brought that into Doctor Who, the idea of time travel as a core concept of the series rather than something that's on the periphery of it that allows it to exist in the way it does.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's done is he's brought time travel in and made that a part of the Doctor Who logic. So you've still got... I think the Doctor Who stories under Stephen Moffat are more Doctor Who than they were under Russell T Davies at a fundamental level.
Yeah.
Because Russell T Davies' stories, as I said earlier, are more about the characters and their relationships, and the deus ex machina that might be in the plot mechanics is not a deus ex machina in terms of character development. What Stephen Moffat's done, I think, is made the plot mechanics more important to the stories. And this is why some people don't like his finales, because his finales tend to be about the plot mechanic, like Clara throwing herself into the Doctor's timeline.
Mm-hmm.
That works for the character, but it works more as a plot mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
So, Stephen Moffat is doing things that are fundamentally Doctor Who, but that have changed slightly the logic of what makes Doctor Who, but in a way where he's brought things from the outside to within Doctor Who, so that the time travel has become integral, and it hasn't really upset the balance of what Doctor Who is in terms of people watching it and seeing those stories. But with Nightmare in Silver, what you have is Neil Gaiman transposing a universe that doesn't fit within that logic. And so you have all sorts of things within that story where there are sort of plot technicalities that don't fit in the universe as laid out by Stephen Moffat.
Mm.
Such as, I'm trying to think of a good example now. But takes a swig of tea. But you have things like Clara. Okay, in Nightmare in Silver, there's a bit where Clara takes charge of the army.
Mm-hmm.
And in a Neil Gaiman fantasy like Coraline, you would have a character, and as part of the curve of the plot, that character would be allowed to do things like that because the logic of the Neil Gaiman universe allows people to make those kinds of leaps. If you watch something like Stardust or Coraline or read his comics, people are making those kinds of leaps all the time because the logic of the universe allows those kinds of leap to be made. In Doctor Who, in order for Clara to take over an army, to become the senior officer in an army, she has to earn it. It doesn't come out of the logic of the universe, it has to come out of the logic of the character.
Yeah.
And although that fits in with where Stephen Moffat is taking Clara, because I think right from the Rings of Akaten, Clara's character is on a trajectory.
Mm.
And in Series 8, we see where that trajectory was taken her.
Yeah.
Nightmare in Silver, where she takes over, in Series 8, you can imagine that.
Yeah.
But in Series 7, it doesn't feel right.
Mm. Mm.
And Nightmare in Silver is full of things that don't feel right because they haven't earned it within the Doctor Who universe, whereas in a Neil Gaiman universe, you wouldn't have to earn it. It would be part of the natural order of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Nightmare in Silver, to me, just feels like an episode of Doctor Who that eschews the natural order of the Doctor Who universe and imposes a different order of things on that universe. Simple things like this fairground where the guy stays behind and like the fairground has become his playground, but mm-hmm. of course he can't fully use that playground because always there's the fear that the Cybermen will turn up. And he even keeps a Cyberman in his living room. In fact, several Cybermen in his living room. In a Neil Gaiman universe, because the logic is so skewed towards Neil Gaiman's logic.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you see what I mean. Towards the nature of Neil Gaiman things.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel out of place because everybody in a Neil Gaiman universe is behaving like that. But in Nightmare in Silver, you've got the children who are not behaving like that.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Doctor and Clara who are not behaving like that. And then you've got this chap who is. And then the Cybermen come in and their behaviour is something separate entirely. And then you've got the soldiers who are supposed to be this ragtag band of soldiers who weren't very good at being soldiers. But they still need to be soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But the way Neil Gaiman paints them is they're not soldiers at all, which is what allows Clara to take over. It's a mass of different things that don't work together. But within the logic of Neil Gaiman, you'd be able to make those things work together. But because you've got the disconnect by being part of the Doctor Who universe,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't. If you take the Doctor and the TARDIS out of Nightmare in Silver, it could be a brilliant story.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. The whole thing feels very... It does feel very Gaiman, that one, right the way through. And so part of the other things that kind of... Part of the production that's flawed, which I've said several times, is I think that a lot of it is that the direction doesn't entirely understand what the script's trying to say, and that's because it's a Neil Gaiman script rather than necessarily a Doctor Who script.
And also because the director's trying to make a Doctor Who story
instead
of a Neil Gaiman story, or vice versa.
Which is why, and it's the biggest thing that goes wrong, which is why Mr. Clever fails. That whole bit, Matt Smith's performance within that, it fails. And it's not his fault because he's given it everything, but he's not giving it in the right direction, because on paper that would work. That would really work on paper, the whole kind of scene, because you don't have someone doing it for you, then you know, on paper, you make the interpretation of the way those lines are delivered in your head and you get it right. But there's no way that you can get it right for a massive audience when it's a single person's interpretation. It would work fine in a comic. It would work fine in a short story. It's something that I've sort of...
In a comic or a short story, the reader interprets it.
And it's not just Gaiman that's got this problem. And I've said this before as well. It's that the problem with that is inherent within their writing style. And same with Bradbury.
The only way you can make that work on screen is by subsuming the rest of the universe that surrounds it to that element of the story.
Yes, you've got it would have to all be pitched at that, and almost like it's just to get that right, as it, because that should have been the tour de force performance that would have made everyone sort of think, that's the best thing Matt Smith's ever done. I've never seen anything like that.
Should have been the best performance ever given in the entire history of the series.
Yes, basically. And the script's there for it to be that, because rather than giving the Matt Smith Doctor a lot of impassioned paragraphs to bellow at green...
things.
like green curtains, which a lot of the rest of the series has been given, you know, and trying to build up to the bit when Murray Gold comes in with a cue for everyone to start weeping. You know, that's which happens a lot through it. Within that, you've got that same kind of that's a showreel type performance should be coming from that. And that's not going to be going on anyone's CV after that as a result, because basically he's hopping around to show a different side of his face and the lighting's changing, and it's like Gollum. It's like the performance of Gollum in Lord of the Rings, which was delivered much better by a CG character. And it's exactly the same principle, which works inside your head, but it doesn't come through in that. And there's other things with it as well, like you said, where you've got... there's some terrible miscasting in it as well. And that can help deflect, where people don't understand what the script's even saying. They don't understand their lines. If you don't understand what you're supposed to be saying, which, in fairness, Beryl Reed gets away with it because she's Beryl Reed, but she doesn't have a clue what she's saying.
No.
You know, it's the same...
But then... stories are a lot less complicated at the time of Earthshock.
Kinder?
Well, I'm talking in terms of audience sophistication.
Oh, right, okay, sorry.
Character sophistication.
Yeah.
Character sophistication. You can get away with Beryl Reed's performance because, in spite of the fact that she might not understand the sci-fi stuff, she understands that as a character, she's not doing anything.
Yes, yeah, totally.
Whereas these days, you can't get away with having a story where a character doesn't do anything. And this, going back to the Curse of the Black Spot, actually, that we mentioned, Curse of the Black Spot is an example of a story where the characters don't really do anything, and on that level, it doesn't really work.
Well, I'd say it's kind of, for Curse of the Black Spot, almost the opposite. It's that people are doing things, but there are no characters there doing them.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, they're just sort of empty vessels with no personality, and nothing for the audience to cling on to in terms of identifying with them.
That's exactly what I mean. The writing of the characters doesn't have the sophistication that you need, because actors these days are used to giving a performance that goes on a trajectory of some kind.
Yeah.
And what they're doing in Curse of the Black Spot is they're just turning up and giving their lines. They're good actors in that, and they're giving good readings of not very much. Mm-hmm. And so I actually quite like Curse of the Black Spot, because I think it works quite well as an old-fashioned Doctor Who story where not very much happens and, you know, it goes to a nice place at the end. I think it works well. I think it would have worked well in the 1970s, or even better still in the 1960s. I think it's a good 1960s Doctor Who story.
I think it would have been a great 60s story.
But
it just is in where it does fall. It's surrounded, like we said, by episodes
stories
of substance.
That do all the things.
Episodes
that
of substance. And then all you end up with is the Doctor gets to wear a different hat. And
Amy
cool.
gets to wave the sword.
Cool. Yeah. Amy gets to wave the sword. And
Rory dies.
And then at the very beginning of the episode, and at the very end of the episode, they might reference something that's going on in the series as a whole.
Yeah.
But the bits in between, nothing. Oh, and a couple of familiar faces. So you've got Lee Ross, what was in Press Gang, and probably more recognisable from EastEnders at this point. And, of course, everyone's favourite posh bloke.
Yeah.
Hugh Bonneville. So...
also known
back
as
to stunt casting.
Also known as Mr. Darcy the Knotter. Well, he reminds me so much of Oh, I've blanked on the actor's name. He's like Colin Firth.
He's nothing like Colin Firth.
He's exactly like Colin Firth.
No, he's baby Jim Broadbent.
With a beard.
He's played young Jim Broadbent because he's young posh Jim Broadbent. That's who he is.
I want to go somewhere completely different now. I want to go back to the very start.
Go on.
I want to look at something in the very first series and say this is one that doesn't have a very good reputation.
Oh,
I
know which
one.
I think this might be one that I was mentioning.
Oh, go on. What were you considering?
No, go on.
No, because I know what
no,
I was...
No, I want you to...
No, because actually, when I say the first series, I mean the first series as it was being made.
Edge of Destruction?
Actually goes out as part of Series 2.
Planet of Giants.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not thought of. Well, there are two reasons why I've picked that now.
Yeah.
And one of them is to examine, does the criteria that we've come up with still work if you're going back to a time before the format of the series was established?
Because
I love Planet Giants.
Because there were three different types of Doctor Who story at this point that were agreed on by the production team. So you've got past, you've got future, and you've got sideways.
And to do that, you have to examine what were they hoping to achieve with those stories. Because the ones in the past...
Education.
About the past.
Yeah.
The ones in the future...
Education. It's a science field trip.
No, it's not.
A little bit.
I think I might side with JR on this, and I don't even know what he's about to say.
All right, okay, go on. Yeah.
For which? Well, to give an example of a little bit, you would say the Daleks. Here is what could be the result of nuclear war.
Yeah.
Sensor riots. Nothing science-y, Y-N-C-y in that.
even with the reference to molybdenum. Which doesn't happen for it.
The future stories and moral dilemmas.
Yes, yeah, they are. Because it went out the window as soon as the Daleks came in. It was never going to be... That all went
If out. It was ever going to be about science, mm-hmm. and you have to concede that given that there's a science teacher and a history teacher, it must at least have been their intention that it was going to be about science. Mm-hmm. As soon as Terry Nation turns up and writes what should be a science story and actually writes a moral dilemma, and from that point forwards, the future stories are all moral dilemmas. Sensor Rights being a great example. It's mm-hmm. all about the rights and wrongs of the situation.
Well, it fixed it, didn't it? Really early on, it was still in a position of being basically very, very malleable. And then the Daleks came along, and they fixed it forever. But if they hadn't, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Planet of Giants.
Yeah,
Planet of the Giants comes in that grey area after the Daleks has fixed it, but the people making it don't realise it's fixed.
Yeah, but it's still a sideways one.
In the same way that Warriors of the Deep is two stories, Planet of the Giants is two stories. And whatever you say about how it was messed around in terms of production being, you know, changed from a four-parter to a three-parter and whatnot, I love it because even though it's the environmental allegory, you can enjoy it as a story, not even noticing that there's an environmental allegory that's supposed to be the A story, but that's actually the B story.
It has a sense of wonder.
It's beautiful to look. It's so good to look at when you consider.
Yeah.
When you consider when it was made and the techniques they were using, it's gorgeous. For quite a long time at work, my desktop background was the Doctor falling down the plug hole.
Yeah. <excellent.
laughs> I love that shot. I think that's gorgeous.
But here's the question then: if when the concept for the series was developed, the future ones were supposed to be science and the past ones were supposed to be historical education. And if after the Daleks, the future ones become more about the moral dilemmas, mm-hmm. what were the sideways ones ever supposed to achieve?
They were only ever going to be miniaturisation, and that was it, basically, from what I can see. Because right at the start, even in the first pitch, they were saying, and there'll be an adventure when the TARDIS is small. And that was it. And that was almost everything they had planned.
Edge of Destruction becomes a sideways story by accident.
Yeah, yeah. Because
and later on, you could say that the Space Museum is a sideways one.
Yes, yeah.
And obviously also Celestial Toymaker, even though that is long after.
Mind Robber still.
Yeah, but these are all after the original production team have gone.
Yes,
so it's like... in the Verity Lambert period.
But anything in space outside of time could be a sideways one, running concurrent with contemporary Earth, but just elsewhere.
Yeah,
no, but the point is, under Verity Lambert, it was history, space, something else.
Yeah, yeah. And the something else just... Once they'd done miniaturisation, that was it. You couldn't do it. It's the same kind of
thing.
They
couldn't think of any more ideas for it.
Yeah, it's what they'll hit as soon as it goes into colour when you've got Alien Invasion, Mad Scientist.
Mm.
Or what? And that's it. Or Sideways One, which is what, I don't know, if we look at Joe's Day Off. You know, that kind of a thing, which it's never going to happen. You can't do it. That's not what it is. There's two different types of story, and you can mash anything within those.
And for our listeners who've been listening to our other recent episodes, 30 seconds ago, that was the sound of Alno slapping his bollocks.
Clean tag, anyone?
You haven't heard our last episode yet.
No.
Why are we doing it in the nip?
My house, my rules.
The sideways ones, mm-hmm. they're doomed from the start. Mm-hmm. Because... education of something factual or educational of something emotional stroke environmental.
Yeah.
What are you going to do apart from that? You've got everything covered. In the past stories, you can look at anything and everything that involves the factual universe. They are ostensibly, obviously, about those parts of history that people would be either expected to know or could read up on about. But the past ones can also look at anything factual from the factual universe,
yeah,
as part of a bigger story. And they can also look at the reasons why, and this is what history is about, the reasons why people have done the things they have done. And the future ones are, you're looking at the people, the reasons why people might do the things that they might do. And because the past ones are set stories, they have to be why people have done the things they've done. Mm. But because the future ones, we don't know what's supposed to happen and how things work themselves out, the TARDIS crew mm-hmm. can affect people's reasons for doing the things that they're going to do. But in between those two extremes, there's no other area for the sideways stories to...
Yeah, they just...
inhabit.
It's just, yeah, there's no room for them, and they're the wrong shape. It's like, I don't know, it's like Tetris with a ball. It's not going to work.
So Planet of Giants occupies this unique space where it's something that was supposed to be one of the central tenets of the series mm-hmm. and actually has become a beautiful oddity
yeah.
in the series.
I don't understand why it's looked upon negatively, because I think as a standalone serial... it's really fun, and it's really good looking, and it's really... I do think it's interesting and engaging.
Right, two things about Planet of Giants then, because it doesn't have a very good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So, given the criteria we talked about before, mm-hmm. is part of the reason it doesn't have a very good reputation because it doesn't... and it might not be an obvious connection between the two ideas, but... is part of the reason why it's not looked on very fondly because it doesn't fit the rules of Doctor Who. And given that the rules of Doctor Who weren't firmly established at that time, do we allow certain other stories that space that we don't allow Planet of Giants for some reason?
Yeah, definitely. The Web Planet is almost a sideways story, but we give that a similar kind of... I mean, I know that Web Planet's got a sort of a reputation for being abysmal. But it's
Web Planet
it's
is one
different.
Of those stories where people say it's abysmal and the director's partly to blame for that, but at least they tried. Nobody ever really says, but at least they tried with Planet of Giants.
No, at least they're doing something different. They're attempting something new because they were all new at this point, weren't they? I mean, the Sensorites was new, Reign of Terror and all that were new. It was new. Although the template had already fixed, they didn't know the template had already fixed because that's only something that becomes apparent later on when someone says... yeah, we need a 6-part story about Daleks. And then another year down the line, well, the last time we had a 6-part story about Daleks, it ran over Christmas and it was quite successful. So let's do that again with a 12-part story about Daleks.
Do you know the Web Planet is the 6-part story about Daleks with no Daleks in it?
Yeah, because they're always trying to recreate the success, which you'll see later on coming to a head with the Dominators when it ends up with people never working on the series again as a result of attempting to replicate that sort of success. And mind you, Nation did it, didn't he?
So maybe the reason why, or maybe the difference between the Web Planet and Planet of Giants is... Web Planet isn't successful, but people give it a certain kind of a buy because they say, at least we can see what it was trying to do. Whereas with Planet of Giants, do people look at it and say, well, we know why they were trying to do what they were trying to do, but we can't really understand it?
Yeah, well, Planet of Giants kind of collapsed. Well,
No, you can understand why they would want to do a the TARDIS crew is miniaturised. But in the format of the series, that doesn't happen. There's no real reason why they should be miniaturised. I mean, they give an explanation. But it's not like Land of Giants, where the series is built around the logic of them being miniaturised. Mm-hmm. In Planet of Giants, they have miniaturised them for that story because they want to tell a story about the TARDIS crew being miniaturised. But it's not something that... It's not something that you can imagine in any other Doctor Who story. It's not something that you can imagine happening regularly. In Land of Giants, it's part of the inherent logic of the series. In Planet of Giants, it's something completely different that they've imposed for that one story because they want to tell that one story.
In the early days of the blog, when we were going through it, when we were watching the stories in order from the first time through, I'd at points come up with a bit of a cliche, which I'd say, which is, and this is where, in a brave and entirely unexpected move, Doctor Who suddenly stops about being, you know, a chap travelling in, you know, adventures in time and space, and becomes about him attempting to eke out a living in the gunfighter's world as a doctor.
To put it this way, the Daleks is the first time they do let's go to outer space and meet monsters.
Yeah.
And because the Daleks work, going to outer space in meeting monsters is what Doctor Who becomes.
Yeah.
But Planet of Giants is, this week, let's go to Earth and be shrunk, and it never happens again.
There's also, there aren't really any monsters in it.
No.
Even the human
monster is man.
Yeah. Turns out it's man. Yeah, but it's the other thing as well is that you've got, they also don't really influence the other story, the, like the kind of the Will Hay film that's taking place around them, that they're sort of stumbling through and not getting trodden on. It's all the events that are occurring in the background. That they don't. It's not driven.
And
by
in the
TARDIS
end,
crew.
They make that phone call, which is kind of imposed on the story in order to make a connection between the two stories. But really, it would have taken very little rewriting to have completely separated them all together.
Yeah.
And actually, it's more of an imposition for that phone call to be a part of the story, because. As much as Planet of Giants would have been a great story where it was only the story of them being miniaturised, I don't think they were brave enough to go that far. And so I think they put in the story about the full-grown people and the environmental thing out of fear.
Although having said that, Barbara gets a good arc in that one.
Yes, she does. Oh, great things happen in that story. It is... Probably the biggest problem with that story is how slow it is, but given where it happens, if you were tuned to the speed of Doctor Who in the 1960s, it's certainly no slower than The Sensorites.
No, definitely. And half the length.
But I think...
I think I may have benefited from seeing Planet of the Giants the first time before I knew that people didn't think so highly of it, and therefore I got to... It's one of those things where if you don't know that you're supposed to don't know that you're supposed to dislike it, you can go, oh, well, I like that about it, and back in my sweet innocent days where I could actually go into watching Doctor Who and not go, right, what can I hate about this? Because that's what happens when you start to love something, you look for things to hate.
So here's my second question about Planet of Giants, which also covers the web planet and the Sensorites and anything else that wasn't successful while Verity Lambert was making Doctor Who and they still didn't know what the format was, even if they'd accidentally invented it. When you watch something like Nightmare in Silver now, instantly afterwards, people are on the forums and instantly it either becomes a classic or it becomes a mediocre Doctor Who episode or it becomes something that people hate. Planet of Giants, between its broadcast and the 1980s, when these large format books about Doctor Who, which said which were the good stories and which were the bad stories, it was seen once in 1964. And the people who watched it in 1964 probably enjoyed it. And 99% of them probably never thought about it again. And probably 100% of them never really thought about it again, except perhaps in a transitory. I remember that one where the Doctor Who people were shrunk. That was fun. Until these books came out, and all of a sudden, well, maybe starting with the Radio Times special in 1973 for the anniversary. And all of a sudden, Planet of Giants becomes part of the canon of Doctor Who. And the Sensorites becomes part of the canon of Doctor Who, and so does the Web Planet, and so does the Daleks and the Dalek invasion of Earth, and everything and everything, anything in between. All of a sudden, when a story Bit of my lunch coming back there. All of a sudden, when a story becomes part of a history of a program, mm-hmm. it has to, by definition, have a status within that history. Because you don't write a history of something without any subjectivity whatsoever. So even though the subjectivity about stories like Planet of Giants and The Celestial Toymaker and The Gunfighters, to give two really good examples, even though that is imposed upon us by people like Jeremy Bentham, who are writing for the Peter Haining books, or people who are writing the Radio Times special, those stories themselves existed outside of that reputation until they became subsumed into how fans think of the programme. So, in the case of something like Nightmare in Silver, if Nightmare in Silver was broadcast to a nation that didn't have the internet and to a nation that didn't have a fandom who could discuss and who could give something its reputation, would Nightmare in Silver, if just broadcast to a population who weren't invested in all these things, would Nightmare in Silver just be a decent Doctor Who story? Would Planet of Giants still be a decent Doctor Who story if it hadn't had its reputation imposed upon it? Mm-hmm. Would Genesis of the Daleks just be, oh, that one where we met the creator of the Daleks? Would Blink just be, oh, that's the story that the Doctor's not in very much? Do these reputations... I mean, I've said that these reputations get imposed upon these things, but how artificial is that imposition, is that reputation?
I completely agree. I do think that the reputation of Planet of Giants is unfair. However, I can completely understand why someone who watched it upon transmission, it might not have affected them in the same way that the first Dalek story you ever saw did, because that, you know, I can understand why it's not one of the ones that really...
No, it probably did, though, because they were shrunk, so it probably...
It's quite a high concept.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was a massive hit.
And for a 1964 audience, I can imagine, because this was before Land of Giants, which started in 1965,
but if I remember. Post-Incredible Shrinking Man, was it not?
Yeah, that was 57.
Right, yeah.
So... But it's not been done, but it's not been done before. So the high concept of it is what should make it not necessarily appeal to an audience, but be something that they would remember.
It is a tricky one, isn't it? Because of course now what happens is, rather than get one person's take on a show that's been fermented for nearly 20 years and turned into almost pure vinegar by the time that it actually reaches publication, you end up with an awful lot of instant knee-jerk reactions that just seem to look like vinegar being poured straight into the echo chamber of the internet instantly afterwards, without any time to actually think about or react to it.
Where I'm going with this is probably the worst Doctor Who story ever, which I think has less going for it than even the Twin Dilemma or Time and the Rani, and that's Time Lash.
Well, yeah, now Time Lash, of course, shouldn't have been made.
But the thing of it is, and the reason why I've come to Time Lash, is I think it was in the audience appreciation reports that there's circumstantial evidence that suggests that the watching public of the day actually enjoyed Time Lash more than any other story in season 22. Or at the very least appreciated it as being as good as the other stories that were around it. And yet some of those other stories, Revelation of the Daleks has a reputation, and Vengeance on Varos has a reputation. So does Attack of the Cybermen. Mark of the Rani to a certain extent. And The Two Doctors has got The Two Doctors in it. All those other stories are remembered for particular things.
Yeah.
Time Lash is only thought of as the rubbish one.
Yeah.
That's all it's remembered for.
It's the whipping boy, isn't it?
And yet the public at the time thought Time Lash was every bit as good as any of those other stories, apparently.
Well, it's got an excellent designer monster in it, because the Borad is very good and the performance of the Borad is excellent. The H.G. Wells idea was good enough that it's been used every single celebrity historical in the new series.
Paul Darrow,
chewing
gives
the scenery.
A performance that people can enjoy.
There is nothing wrong with Paul Darrow's performance within Time Lash. It is perfect.
He is entertaining a watching audience at home.
Mm-hmm.
And as fans, we might think that's ridiculous, but as viewers, we would just be entertained by what he's doing.
Yeah, and a lot of these things actually compensate for the script because the script isn't strong enough to hold it together, in my opinion.
So half an hour or so after our go on, Betsy, you're about half an hour ago after our actual conclusion, I think the conclusion that we are actually coming to is, as fans, we look at particular stories as being not successful because they don't adhere to what we think of as Doctor Who, whereas if we were just viewers rather than fans, our investment levels would be set differently and we would appreciate all of the stories in an entirely different way. And we might find that our favourites and least favourites were entirely different stories to the ones we probably think of them as being. Yes or...
Yeah, no, that sounds good. That sounds good because I know that when you've got Dark Water and Death in Heaven, Dark Water, that hit all the kind of fan triggers that went through, and then Death in Heaven, not necessarily quite so much, but everyone I know who watched Death in Heaven, who wasn't what you call a Doctor Who fan, they thought that that was a superior episode because it touched an awful lot of emotional things that really came as a bit of a shock to them that it would be dealing with something in that much depth. And it's the scene in the graveyard, which is what that whole story is actually about, but not if you're a Doctor Who fan.
Exactly. Guys, we have to split up now because we have things like trains to catch.
I've got helicopters to the Arctic.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining me.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, this was a bit impromptu.
Can we get dressed now?
So that was it. Betsy Chevron from Bin Row was right. And if you want to hear lots more of this kind of thing, because that's basically all you do on Bin Row was right.
Pretty much.
So
interrupt each other,
Interrupt each other, but talk about this kind of thing.
Yeah, we try.
So people find the Bin Row was right podcast, and there's a lot more of that there. Mm-hmm. Okay, then, until next week, I was JR.
I was Al.
I was Betsy Chevron.
And we will speak again soon.